Hello, it's Friday, 8th of January, 2021. I'm Hannah Pearson from Per Anderson.
And I'm Gary Bowerman from Check In Asia.
This episode carries on from our previous episode, which was a 21-point travel list for 2021. And this is part two.
Yep, let's get started. This is 21 for 2021. This is the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thanks for listening in. Well, last episode, we talked points 1 to 11 of what we would love to see happening in 2021. And we've got 10 more to cover this episode, haven't we, Gary?
Yeah, so just to backtrack, Hannah and I decided to kick off the year by discussing our hopes for travel and tourism in Southeast Asia and beyond in the critical markets that affect our travellers. And so we brainstormed a 21-point wish list, and we are discussing this in two separate parts. Part one you can find on our website or wherever you normally catch your podcasts. And here we go from numbers 12 through to 21. So let's get started, Hannah. The first pick looks quite serious.
Yeah, well, it is. And I think this is a hope not only from us, but probably for the whole tourism industry, that travel should be more meaningful. To be honest, I think that even consumers now, when they're thinking about travel, having not traveled for a whole year, it really means something now, doesn't it? It's not so much of a, oh, where am I going to go this weekend? Oh, I'll book it last minute. Now travel is something that has to be thought out. It has to be something that is planned ahead. And through that, it adds a little bit more meaning, doesn't it?
I think it does. I think you're absolutely right. There is definitely a heightened sense of anticipation. People haven't been able to travel for more or less a year right now, apart from domestically. And people, I think, are getting, particularly in the smaller countries, getting a little bit bored of going to the same places domestically. It's going to be a big leap, a big hurdle to travel internationally again. We don't quite know when it's actually going to be able to happen. But I do think that when travel comes back, we probably won't be traveling as frequently as we did before. So there is going to be, I think, a greater sense of heightened anticipation, probably greater research, and really, really looking into destinations and experiences that are going to have a real meaning that really enable you to get away, reflect on what's happened before, what's happened in life, you know, what's happened in the world, and just have a proper holiday again. Because for a lot of people, that hasn't been possible for a long period of time.
Absolutely. Should we move on to point two? And this was one of your ones, I think. Strategize, don't politicize domestic travel. Is that another rant, Gary?
Not so much a rant. It certainly links into point one there, doesn't it? You know, we've seen this real focus over the past year on domestic travel, which didn't happen before. Most countries in our region have always viewed domestic travel as the third prong of travel, really, inbound, outbound. And then domestic didn't really get the tourist dollars. It didn't really get the spending, the marketing. Obviously, that's changed in the past year because people can't go anywhere else. Airlines can't fly anywhere else. We've all been constrained within borders. And quite frankly, at the moment, it's looking as though that's going to be the case for, well, we don't know, but certainly maybe the first half of this year at least. So I think what we've seen is this shift in terms of the way the travel industry and governments look at domestic travel. Whether they've actually innovated and whether they've actually thought about this in the longer term, I'm not quite sure. But I think we have to get away from this idea that domestic travel is just to help boost economies. It's not. This, you know, people want to travel and discover more of their own countries and actually enjoy it, not just be a number that's contributing to an economic recovery. I just think that downplays the value of travel a little bit. And people really want to get out and see destinations in different ways as well, enjoy the countries in different ways. So let's see a bit more innovation and a little bit less of the politics side.
Yeah, I agree with that, actually. You know, there is, like you say, so many governments are encouraging their citizens to travel as if it's a kind of civic duty, and it's not necessarily inspirational, is it? You want to travel to be inspired, you want to travel to be relaxed, you don't particularly want to travel just because your government tells you should be traveling. So absolutely, more strategy behind that, particularly in terms of the marketing language used by governments to encourage this to happen. they need to up their game, I think, 2021.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I think to a degree last year in 2020, it was kind of understandable. You know, it was a stopgap. Nobody quite knew what that interim period, nobody knew how long the pandemic was going to endure. Economies were being really badly hit, especially with the cutting off of international travel. So there was, you know, this kind of idea that, well, people can stand up. And like you said, civic duty is a great phrase to describe. But I think this year has to be a little bit more longer term. Let's look at domestic tourism, not just as a pandemic era issue, but as something that actually can benefit people and businesses as well as the economy for the longer term. Let's look at it a little bit further ahead.
So that brings us neatly actually to our next wish, which is stepping up self-drive travel. And we've seen this trend towards cities, especially last year, getting more domestic tourists if they are within, or destinations getting more domestic tourists if they are within driving distance of tier one, tier two cities. But there's so much more that can be done, I think, with self-drive. And right now, you know, governments have been pretty much relying on people getting there under the power of their own steam and not really, I suppose, not maximizing that whole experience. Of course, there's, when you're driving somewhere, you're not just going from point A to point B. You can make it into a whole road trip, can't you? And you can bring value to everybody who is along that road trip in terms of stopping off at certain cafes or stopping off at certain attractions on the way there. Driving to another place for a holiday shouldn't just be a matter of going from A to B. What do you think?
Well, I agree with that. I think on two parts, for travelers themselves, it gives you a chance to get off track to go and see places that you otherwise wouldn't be able to if you're just relying on flights or trains or, you know, forms of public transport. So you can get out and see much more of a country. And then from the country and the destination's point of view, it's great for user-generated content because people are actually seeing places that they wouldn't otherwise and photographing places they wouldn't otherwise get to. You know, those go viral. People pick up on that. You know, this idea going forward in travel that marketing isn't just going to be done by travel brands or tourism boards. It's going to be done by travelers themselves increasingly. You know, user-generated content and peer-to-peer recommendations are going to be vital for rebuilding travel. And self-drive is great for that. You see that a lot in Australia. You see that a lot in New Zealand. There are a lot of opportunities here in Southeast Asia. It just hasn't really been pushed that hard. In recent months, a couple of countries, Thailand has made some sort of move towards developing its infrastructure. It's talking about a Thailand Riviera, where it builds road routes along the Gulf of Thailand, the Mekong River, and into the Khao Yai Mountains. That's an opportunity. In Laos, if you look this year, the Vientiane Vang Vieng highway, which is only about 120 kilometers long, but eventually that's going to be extended to the Chinese border. So that means you can drive all the way through Laos. So I think it's going to be an infrastructure issue as well as a marketing issue. And I think over the next 5 to 10 years, self-drive travel in our region is going to become a big portion of the cake.
Yeah, and it's not even just cars, but even in the Philippines last year, they were just starting to develop motorbike tourism as well. And they were having these, you know, big groups of motorbike travelers traveling together in convoy. And that's a pretty cool idea as well that can be developed. So yeah, there's so much that you can go when you start looking at self-drive travel.
Yeah, totally agree. Which brings us on, so we're looking at sort of new trendy type aspects of travel going forward. And one of those is culinary tourism. We'd like to see a little bit more of an imaginative approach to culinary tourism rather than just relying on traditional standard national dishes, that kind of thing. We'd like to see a little bit more imagination, would you say, Hannah?
Yeah, and I think this also plays back to domestic tourism, again, in that angle, because I think a lot of culinary tourism that has been created in terms of products, tourism products in Southeast Asia, is largely geared towards the international market. And of course, the international market probably has a much more basic understanding of the national cuisine and the ingredients and the techniques and things. But if you're talking about your marketing culinary tourism to domestic tourists, of course, they're going to have far higher expectations. They're going to have a far greater level of expertise when it comes to understanding the ingredients and the cooking methods. You've got to go the extra mile. You've got to make it that bit more imaginative.
You've got to go into the backstories, I think. It's not just about the dining experience or the ingredients that you see in the restaurant itself. They want to know about the chef. They want to know about the chef's motivations, their backgrounds, where they've cooked before, how they integrate local cuisines with elements of international cooking, want to go and find out where these artisan foods are made, where the ingredients are actually produced and nurtured. And there's a whole big backstory issue with culinary tourism, which hasn't really been tapped yet. There's a lot of opportunities there.
Definitely. Our next wish is that travel brands be careful of cutting too many costs, because they show. And 2020 has had to be a time of cutting costs. It's been the only way for many, many travel businesses to survive, and it's been necessary. But in 2021, I think these travel businesses need to make sure that they have cut costs in the right places, and that, you know, the cracks are not starting to show. Because when people do go on holiday, they want that quality experience. And I think nowadays people are, yes, you know, we said in the previous podcast, people are looking for cheap. But I think that there is also this association that cheap sometimes doesn't equal safe. And if you are appearing like you're cutting corners, there's that worry, well, what else are they cutting corners on? Are they cutting corners on safety or on hygiene?
Yeah, I noticed this over Christmas and New Year traveling in Malaysia. And to some degree, you're right. It's not actually the hotel or the airlines or whoever's involved fault. They've actually been forced to cut costs, so there are less staff particularly. But at busy periods, it really, really shows. So a couple of the resorts that we visit in Langkawi, that they are short-staffed. There's no question about this. And the problem is that when you have big rushes, big periods of travel like New Year, you have a lot of people there. You're basically trying to manage what would ordinarily be a very busy period with a lot less staff. Unfortunately, that means that some customers get a little bit fractious because things don't happen as quickly as they expected beforehand. A few corners have been cut in terms of restaurant services and things like that. And it's very difficult then to manage the relationship between guests and hotels because, you know, you have upset customers. I think we're going to have to realize that for the foreseeable future, this is going to be an issue, that places, whether it's hotels or it's airports, airlines, museums, whatever, are going to be slightly short-staffed, and we're probably not going to get the same levels of service that we were used to beforehand. But at the same time, I think the travel providers have to be aware of this as well, particularly at peak times, and they're going to have to scale up to meet those challenges.
Yeah, they're going to need more flexibility, aren't they, to be able to scale up to meet peak periods and be able to scale back for those kind of off-peak periods.
Yeah, it's tricky. I mean, this is a new challenge, really. They've never really had these sort of peaks and troughs so pronounced as they are right now. And they've had to, obviously, just to stay in business, they've had to cut their costs back. It's, you know, and this is going to take time to iron out. I think it's just going to take patience on everybody's side.
So moving to more health related, our next wish is having a health passport or some kind of vaccination verification process, but that's workable even in low-tech countries. So the last couple of months, we've seen people like IATA come out with the idea of these travel passes and an app, and Singapore Airlines trialing an app where the airlines will be able to verify that the tests that passengers are traveling with, the RT-PCR tests, are genuine. But this is all very well and good, but is very tech driven. You know, if we're talking about clinics being able to issue this in rural Indonesia, they're probably not going to have access to this high level of tech. And it's going to be impossible to get every single clinic to sign up to this kind of scheme as well. There needs to be some kind of low tech version, whether it is as simple as something like a yellow fever certificate for vaccinations, for COVID vaccination, that will help travel get moving again. What do you think?
There's two aspects to this, isn't? Well, there's three probably. The one aspect is, you said, that we have to make sure there is a verification process, that it is accurate, and that, you know, if people are vaccinated and when they update their vaccines, we don't yet know how long vaccines are actually going to be effective for. So there has to be this process, but there has to be an information sharing process, and that's where, as you said, the technology comes in, and that's where the whole thing falls down, because really, to have this, to make it successful for everybody, it's got to be a universal system. Now, if you go back to the G20 summit, November, I think, the Chinese president suggested that the world has this QR code health passport. Now, obviously, the rest of the world is not going to accept a Chinese technology solution to this, so politics gets involved. Politics gets involved of actually the information sharing that we're going to absolutely need if we're going to have these travel flows that the industry needs to get back. The other side of it, of course, as well, is forgeries. And we're seeing quite an increasing number of forged PCR test certificates, that kind of thing. You know, that absolutely baffles me because I don't really understand that level of depraved business sense that, you know, you're basically willing to allow people to transmit the virus. That is just astonishing given the situation that we're in. But that does happen, of course. But it's the information sharing, isn't it? It's the gathering, the collating and the sharing of information, which, you know, that breaches all sorts of issues of privacy and data and all this kind of thing. But these are issues that can become really into the fray this year, because if we want to get people traveling again, they're going to have to be vaccinated. There's no question about that. The health passport or the certification is going to have to be accepted in different countries. And we've got so many different vaccines, you know, which ones will be accepted, which ones won't be accepted. It's a minefield, isn't it?
Yeah. When you start taking into account the different methods that they're using, what happens if they mix them? Yeah. I don't envy the person, or hopefully many people, who are going to have to come together and come out with some process for this.
But in the meantime, before vaccination, your next point, Hannah, this is a really important point, is that we need a less invasive, expensive and accurate way of testing RT-PCR tests. We need to make it compulsory before every flight. But again, that information has to be shared.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, when you look at surveys of travelers again and again, one of their biggest concerns and worries is having to have this RT-PCR test, because it's seen as something very uncomfortable, it's seen as something quite invasive, and they're expensive and they take a long time in some cases for the test results to come back. So I think that the industry really needs to be working in tandem with the vaccinations, but they need to be developing sensitive, fast, cheap ways of being able to test for COVID-19, and then, like we were saying, roll that out before every flight so that you never end up in this situation of people on arrival testing positive. All right, this is one of the biggest blockers, and we are going to be still testing. We were saying this last year, still we're still going to be testing before travel for the foreseeable future, even with vaccinations. So something needs to be sped up here.
Yeah, some of the solutions that would be seen, you know, they tend to just be regionalized or even nationalized. So I think in Hong Kong, there's been a saliva test. Indonesia has been looking into a breath test to detect COVID-19. In India, there was this paper test. I think we saw that was quite interesting. That was a touch test. But again, these things sort of come and go, and we don't really find out whether they become long-term solutions and whether they're going to be accepted in other countries. That's going to be the issue, isn't it? Is how interoperable these things are. It's like the vaccines, it's a minefield, but without them, we're still stuck in the same issues that we were talking about maybe 8 or 9 months ago.
Gosh, that's a depressing thought. So moving on to perhaps another depressing one, depending on where you stand. Another wish for this year is tourism get more earth friendly, but is that possible? Is that realistic? Are they just, you know, incompatible with one another? Can tourism really be sustainable?
I think is it possible? Well, it hasn't proved possible so far, has it? We've up to the point of 2019, we've seen huge problems with climate change, with plastic trash, all these kinds of things. Some of them are related definitely to travel. There's no doubt about that. But if you're looking at the way the media is starting to move and starting to turn, you know, we've been talking about travel and tourism for a year now across all media platforms, and that's been related to the pandemic. As the pandemic, well, we don't know when this starts to ease away. Let's say that it does start to ease away the second half of the year. The next big agenda for the international media is going to be climate change, because they're going to need something big again to start talking about over a big period of time. And the climate agenda is definitely going to be part of that. So tourism has to be ready for that, because tourism could really move from one really, really debilitating situation to another. If travel and tourism starts happening again and environmental damage increases at the same time, you know, I think we're going to start seeing airlines and airline fuels and these kind of things coming under much greater scrutiny. It's a coming storm, I think, and I think the travel industry has to be ready for this.
Yeah, Agreed. I think it's going to be the next big issue. So tourism businesses need to start getting in front of that now, even though it's hard to even know what's going to happen next week. You've got to plan longer term, I think.
I think it's the small details. I think you just have to start with the small details, you know, making sure that you have earth-friendly, you know, bathroom amenities, you remove as many plastics as you can. But, you know, the bigger issues of the problem is that we are still going to be seeing a lot more construction of resorts, of roads, of railways. And, you know, those big construction projects aren't particularly earth-friendly.
So our penultimate wish for 2021 is hotels get more flexible on check-in and check-out times. And we've seen for so many years, hotels have been so strict, aren't they? Their check-in is at 3, check-out is 12 or 11, but especially this year and at the end of last year, you know, people are checking into hotels, but they want the flexibility. They, if they turn up at a destination, they don't want to be hanging around in hotel lobbies, you know, for hours until they're able to check in. And if they have to check out early and their flight isn't till late, they're not going to want to hang around again in all these public spaces until they can finally get on that flight. So hotels really need to be flexible, and being flexible is also a good way of attracting clients as well, I think, and being able to charge more of a, not necessarily a premium for prices, but perhaps charging just what you were charging in 2019 without having to drop your prices by offering that extra perk of flexible check-in, check-out times.
Yeah, I think with the hotel sector, this change will come from within. We are starting to see it. Some of the upper end brands are starting to be a bit more flexible on check-in and check-out times. That has, to some degree, been facilitated by the pandemic because occupancies have been a lot lower. So therefore, you know, you don't have the same inventory fill that you would have normally. So you can be a little bit more flexible in turning around rooms than you would have been, you know, 18 months ago. But I think this is seen as a point of difference. And I think hotels are going to come under a lot of pressure for competition with each other. And certainly with the Airbnb sector, you know, the home rental sector, is that hotels are starting to innovate a lot more to try and differentiate what they do. Obviously, this tends to be at the upper end, but I think it will also be at the lower end as well. But the problem, the other problem I think that's going to make this even more important is the days of when you could choose your flight, you know, you had several flights a day between city pairs in our region. Now that's going to take a while to come back. So it's going to be a little bit more hard to schedule your check-in, your check-out times simply based on your airport arrival and departures. So hotels are going to have to be a little bit more flexible through necessity, I think. I think we will see this definitely at the upper end. I think hotels have got the message, and I think they want to find new ways to embrace the change that's going to happen in travel. So I think there will be some innovations, but it will take time to roll out. And again, you know, the other problem is that we mentioned earlier, it's staffing levels. To manage these more flexible and these new innovative schemes that they want to put forward, they need the staffing levels, which, you know, that might take a little bit of time to scale up again.
And our last wish for 2021 actually doesn't come from Gary or I. It actually comes from Kel Willis, who is the Global Head of Marketing, Communications and PR at Celilona Sojourns, based in Bangkok. And she wants to see more consistency in tourism marketing that's promoting integrity in the industry rather than so much negativity and bias, as well as an agility to move away from what we did or thought was the right way to promote tourism and what tourism is for the masses or niche markets, and accept that travel in a post-COVID world might be very different to what we're accustomed to. Gary, what's your take on that?
I couldn't agree more with both of those points. The second point I think is extremely important. I like that idea that we have to move away from what we thought worked before or what did work before. I think we're going to see different patterns of travel. We might see different market flows. We might see different inbound and outbound flows. We might see different markets becoming more important. We cannot get away from the fact that domestic is going to be very, very important for the foreseeable future, even if we do have inbound and outbound back. So I totally agree with that. Businesses are going to have to be agile. And I think they realize that. I think all tour operators have had such a bad, and travel business have had such a bad year, that they realize that they have to offer more, they have to offer different things, and they have to be agile. I think when it comes down to the consistency in tourism marketing to make it more positive and less negative is simply going to be difficult because of the situations that we're in. But, you know, it's a mindset thing, isn't it? And travel and tourism is generally, or it should be, it's a happy product. You know, it's a product that gives people happiness. It allows people to fulfill their dreams, their fantasies. You know, that sounds like sort of fluff, but it's not really. We travel because we want to enjoy ourselves. We want to do things that we can't do ordinarily and go and see places and cultures and foods that give us a new perspective on life. So absolutely, we have to get rid of that negativity and that bias. But at the same time, we've had a whole year of negativity and bias, and it's very difficult to wash away.
Yeah, well said. I think you said it all there, so I will leave it there. And that brings us to the end of part two of our 21 for 2021 travel wishlist show. We hope you enjoyed both podcasts, and don't forget to send us your thoughts and comments on what we said or what we missed out. You can drop us an email at hello@theseasiatravelshow.com or message us on our LinkedIn page at the Southeast Asia Travel Show or on Twitter at SEA Travel Show.
Meanwhile, you can catch up with the Southeast Asia Travel Show's full 2020 back catalogue plus part one of our 21 for 2021 podcast on our website, www.theseasiatravelshow.com, or on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Podchaser, Castbox, Podcast Addict, and Stitcher. Just search for the Southeast Asia Travel Show on each app.
And that's a wrap for our two-part podcast of 2021. And we're both off to start planning an ASEAN-themed special edition. Have a great week and stay safe and healthy.
Yeah, thanks very much. Bye-bye.